You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Broken records. The albums you wouldn't shut up about. Broken records. The music our guests can't live without.
Like Judy.
Barbara.
Liza.
Bette.
Betty.
Audra.
Bernadette.
We broadcast this podcast with hopes that someday we might get Patti LuPone.
Welcome to Ben Rimmelauer's Broken Records on Broadway World, Broadway Podcast Network, and now Broadway On Demand. I'm Ben Rimmelauer, and I'm here virtually recording this episode with, as usual, the loveliest co-host on God's green earth, Daniel Nolan.
Thank you. Hey, y'all. So happy to be here. We have a very, very, very special guest today.
Yes, we do. You all know him from his infamous, notorious Instagram account, Dublin_Zotrope, where he has made minced meat of Glenn Close. Yes. And his name is Mark, and we think he is so brilliant, and we know you do too, and we are so happy to have him today to quarantine with us. Fuck me, I forgot the name. The amazing HBO documentary about Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher, something, something, Bright Lights.
Bright. It's just called Bright Lights.
Bright Lights. Please say hello, Mark.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. Your listeners don't know who I am at all.
And they are all fan. Are you crazy?
I guarantee you every one of our listeners knows Dublin Zotrope.
Yes, you have way more followers than we do.
I know, but they're not really real ones. I mean, they're mostly sort of, you know, teenage girls in the Midwest, I think. And they sort of...
I don't know if that's the case.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I feel like your fans are our fans, and then you have other fans who don't like us.
Oh, right, well, that's very true.
Yeah, well, I just, you know, thank you for having me on, and I must excuse myself to your guests and say it was a lean week and you had nobody else to ask. And
you are first choice.
I cannot even get into this humility from you. I hope that it's false. I hope that deep down inside, you know how brilliant and fabulous you are.
Oh, thank you.
Everybody that I know adores you.
Oh.
And I'm just so tickled. I feel like we have like a real exclusive here because I know you said something on Instagram about, you know, being open to doing interviews and podcasts, but like, have you done any others? Like, are we the first one?
Well, more or less, because I did do a test one with these two fetal gays in sort of...
Hashtag fetal gays. Spelled the British way, which is, what is it? F-O-E? Love.
Well, I did do a test one with them and sort of recorded, and they said my accent was too hard for their listeners to understand.
What?
So, I don't think that's true.
I think they just didn't like you and they used the accent as the excuse because your accent is very easy to understand and I have bad hearing.
Well, yeah, I was expecting it to be way more intense, but it's totally. Just slight.
Yeah, well, totally. And more than that, I mean, I didn't want to go on podcasts if people thought I was some hick shouting into a tin can with string. And really, the sound quality is probably so poor. That's probably what people think I am doing. But
You know, I think especially nowadays in COVID times, people are not so hung up on sound quality. I mean, we did our first few episodes like in a recording studio with an engineer. And then, you know, eventually we were just like going over to people's houses with like our $30 Amazon mics. And like, yeah. And now, you know, we do it on a computer. Some of our guests don't have any kind of a microphone device attached, and it's fine. It's all about the content, you know? I mean, it's not like an audiophiliac experience.
I know, I felt you're sort of drawing the ASMR crowd or something, and I was going to let them all down.
No, definitely not our crowd.
Oh my God, you're just so smart, you know? Your references are always just so specific and so rich and so perfect and hilarious and witty. And I mean, I'm just, honestly, I'm still shocked. And now that I saw you in that little Insta video that you posted, and now that I'm hearing your voice, I understand that I think you told me you're 24, is that right?
Well, that's not correct, but I'll go with that.
You're in your 20s, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I first started following you, I was convinced you were like me in my mid-60s, at least.
No, I think people sort of either think I'm some sort of, you know, 16-year-old tragic gay somewhere, or else I'm some elderly queen sort of whining about Glenn Close. But no, I'm in my 20s, yes.
Yes, I assumed the latter. I mean, I really thought you were going to be like much older.
Yeah.
But I mean, it just speaks to why you are so successful and why you're so brilliant and well-loved on Instagram is because you have the tech savvy and kind of the, you know, you have your finger on the pulse of what's trending and what's popular in like the zeitgeist as like a young person. But then you have this aesthetic and this deep, deep knowledge of, you know, pop culture, much of it, which has to do with, you know, older movies and films and Hollywood and
but not that. So old. I mean, you know, I'm really turned off. I mean, just when we were waiting for you to join the call, Daniel and I were talking about how he loves Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and he just rewatched it. And I was saying that I love Marilyn, but I fucking hate that movie and movies like that. Most old movies are such a turnoff to me. It's only like the very, 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 you know, cream of the crop, the Sunset Boulevards and the All About Eves that I can really enjoy. And I always feel everything that you reference is like right in the sweet spot of everything I love.
But yet you do talk about like old, like Hollywood actresses and stuff like that. So I guess my point is you are such a great blend of both worlds. And I think that's why a lot of these instigays especially are so drawn to you and your work.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's work. And I mean, let's face it, there are Riverdale fan accounts that have, you know, 20 times as many followers as I do. But you're
not a fan account. I mean, I was actually shocked. There was that great story on you. Now I can't remember what publication it was in.
W Magazine.
And W Magazine, yeah. Free. Yeah. Everyone should read it.
Well, I don't, because the person makes terrible grammar errors that wrote it. And I did write
well,
to them.
Well, that's 2020. They all fucking do that nowadays.
I know.
Even the New York Times.
Well, first of all, they spelled Dublin Zoetrope wrong. And then I had to write them about four times to change it. I feel like Barbara ringing up Tim Cook to sort of change her name on the phone.
Oh, my God.
And then, of course, they changed that, but they left the grammar mistake. So I don't want to get that person in trouble that wrote it. But
well, whatever. It was a good article. Content. But the thing is, the thing about the article that it made me realize was, of course, you're a Glenn Close fan. And I'm bringing this up not to have some fight about Glenn Close, but to say that it's so wrong to refer to you in any way along the lines of like a fan account. Because even with Glenn, whom you love, you're so merciless to her, you know?
Well,
and I aspire to that. I mean, you know, I love me some Patty, but I pride myself on being able to laugh at Patty a lot of the time. But I don't think I'm as free with Patty as you are with Glenn.
I know. And I mean, I'm not sure if Glenn does listen to this podcast, but if she does.
She does not.
She does not. I guarantee.
I mean, I feel so guilty. I mean, that poor woman, because I'm not talking about her at all. I'm really talking about myself, you know. And there's just something about Glenn that kind of really strikes me as bitter gay man who couldn't make it in musical theatre. So I sort of use her as the conduit for all my sort of bitterness. And I'm really not talking about Glenn Close, who's a wonderful woman. And I love that she has her own Instagram that's just so wholesome and pure.
Which is, yeah, fabulous.
Yeah. I know.
I think that's such a good point to make. Cause I mean, you know, like Ben was talking about with Patty. I mean, I feel like, you know, I worship Barbara Streisand so much, but like, I also hate her so much because of like the qualities that she possesses that I despise in myself and others. Mm. So like, I mean, I think that's part of, you know, kind of the way we choose these ladies to worship and to idolize. It's like we love them and we hate them. And it's because, like you're saying, they're that conduit through which...
But it's so rich and layered with you and Glenn, because it's like, you know, what you say is accurate, you know, and I can see that throughout your posts about a bitter gay man who failed in musical theater, you know, and that's such a perfect lens for Glenn Close, because not only does it highlight her as the bitter loser, it also is also fucking triumphant, because who can you compare her to in musical theater? Who has more talent than she does for musical theater? Bernadette Peters, Patti LuPone, et cetera, et cetera. They would all give their left and right tit to be Glenn Close. You know, I mean, it's like she's still resplendent. You know, Glenn Close, haha, fuck you, you're no Meryl Streep, but she's number two. It's like, there's something so regal about Glenn Close, despite the like so-called bitterness. And in a way, as much as you shit on her, you point that out, because to even talk about her in the context of musical theater, I mean, she's almost more in common musical theater-wise with Barbara Streisand and Liza Minnelli and Bette Midler, who were two, they just flew the coop. You know, musical theater is in their dust.
Yeah, and it's also like, Glenn is such a huge star and a celeb. It's like, you know, I think people like Glenn and Barbara and Bette, it's like those people can stand up to this sort of irreverent scrutiny and, you know, behavior, because it's not like there's a struggling actress who's trying to make it work. You know, they're actually like, they've already... you know, set their legacy in stone, and they can withstand that.
Now, Mark, correct me did you start this account after she lost the Oscar, or am I just getting my timeline mixed up?
Oh, no, I started this account, I'd say, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. I used to write a blog that was called Dublin Zoetrope that nobody read. It got sort of, you know, 10 hits per year. And the only people that read it were me and, you know, probably some child somewhere that kept refreshing the page. But I went on Instagram then and used that name, and I was the great hit of Instagram, whereas the blog never got anywhere. And, you know, so I've been doing it for, I'd say, easily 3 or 4 years. And it's only kind of maybe in the last year since that Oscar thing that really people have followed me. And I'm very grateful to those people that follow me. And I don't want to ascribe any importance at all to it, because it is just sort of hurling abuse at these elderly actresses. But still, it is great fun to do.
But it's also, I mean, it's not just abuse. It's like, I mean, one of my favorites, I always think about it, one of my favorite posts you ever did was the Ladies of the Hours trading cards. And it's just like really, really brilliant. And I mean, there's that one, and then there's so many others that I could talk about, but that's always the one I always think about, because just the idea of someone thinking of the women of the movie The Hours as trading cards is just like so delicious and something I would buy.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Well, I do think though, The Hours really is the kind of cornerstone for sort of basic gays. It's sort of, you know, not the gateway drug, but it's the kind of, the patient zero or something, you know, they all know The Hours. And I just thought I'd do it with that rather than, you know, with some other, but anyway, I mean, people get very,
so brilliant.
People get very passionate about The Hours, in which one of the women is the best of them. And, you know, it's very tiresome. I think, you know, it's quite obvious that Meryl is head and shoulders above the other two, because Nicole has that fake nose and Julianne stands there. So, you know, that's really
it's so funny. I actually have had this debate at many dinner parties, and most people say Julianne Moore.
Julianne is so smart, because she's always is so earnest. Or no, she's always so broad, but the films that she does and the performances are earnest. And if you're broad in earnest material, I mean, it's a hat trick. I mean, you get away with it. And I do like Julianne, but again, you know, she's not a great favorite. I mean, I can't believe I'm talking about this. I mean, I honestly think I must be high or something. But
no, get it out. Get it out. This is the place.
Yes, yes.
I thought we were talking about Carrie and Debbie today.
Yes, well.
Anyway, well, yeah, it's a good too.
That's a good transition. I must say, I must tell your listeners that you sent me a whole ream of different films and concerts and things to choose from. And I said, first, we better do somebody where the two of them are dead, because I thought, you know, it would be so unfair, just, you know, whoever. Because I do feel, you know, Carrie and Debbie's death 3 years or 4 years ago, I mean, it was, I think, for gay people, it was the kind of Michael Jackson moment. I mean, people remember where they were. When they heard that Carrie died, and then the next night where Debbie had passed as well. So
I have to say, when you chose this, and honestly, when Daniel even put it on the list, I was very disappointed. Because I watched it a couple of times when it first came out. Because it came out, like, right after they died, right?
It came out the Sunday after they died. They had filmed it for, I think, Mother's Day or something. It was going to be the Mother's Day special on HBO.
Right.
And they said, oh, we'll shove it out because, what happened.
Well, so I watched it a couple of times because I was so obsessed. I've always been obsessed with Carrie because there used to be a TV show on IFC in the 90s, I think, called Dinner for Five. And it was hosted by Jon Favreau. And he always had four different actors, writers, directors. And they would just talk and eat dinner. And it was edited down to, 45 minutes or whatever to go within the commercial breaks. And it was, and Carrie was a very regular guest, always smoking. And the impression she made on me then, I mean, obviously she'd been a movie star to me and I'd already been a fan of Postcards from the Edge, although I don't think I'd read it yet, but just from the movie. But the impression she made on me actually inspired me later when I got sober. I wasn't worried about not being interesting anymore because I knew that Carrie Fisher sober, you didn't have to turn into like a sort of earnest, basic gay just because you quit drinking and, whatever. So Carrie gave me that knowledge. But anyway, so I'd watched the movie like twice, the documentary when it first was on. And then I think I was dating this guy who wanted to see it. And we kept putting it on and either having sex or putting it on and falling asleep. So I watched like the first, half an hour, like 10 times. And so the last fucking thing I wanted to do was rewatch it, I thought. And I have to say that when I turned it back on last night, almost from the first frame, I was just like, oh my God, I love them both so fucking much. This is the greatest thing I've ever seen. I'm so fucking excited to watch this.
Well, I think, I talked about it on Zoe. I just called Dublin Zoetrope Zoe, like Zoe Caldwell. But
like Audra's daughter.
I say Audra's daughter if the people don't know who Zoe Caldwell was. But I mean, are they likely to know Audra, if they don't know? Well, I don't know. But anyway, but I talked about it a few weeks ago and I don't know who sent it to me, but they said it was the Grey Gardens of sort of the last 10 years. And I know that is a bit of an exaggeration. I mean, it is kind of hyperbole to say that. But I mean, it's not an outrageous comparison. I think, there's a lot.
I mean, there are so many similarities. And I think the only difference is, these ladies had much more money and social standing and, obviously like actual class. But like... I mean, we can get into it, but Debbie is definitely a little bit of a hoarder, and some of these
and
scenes.
And so is Carrie.
And so is Carrie. But the difference is they have the resources. I mean, it's kind of like Barbara,
Right.
Hoarders with resources.
I know. Well, I think, I know everyone always talks about Carrie's house that has, sort of the Prozac tiles in the kitchen. But I actually think Debbie's house is sort of really chintzy and it's, the pictures of June Allison and Anne Blythe on the wall. The Maltese Falcon and the ruby slippers on the mantelpiece. I mean,
it's like the huge 8x10 of Cary Grant.
But I mean, the thing is about that with Debbie, like so many like famous old people who have tons of money have like very out of date style in their homes.
Well, I mean, you know? Look at Barbara. I mean, her taste is appalling.
Well, but Barbara's shit is new. I mean, Barbara buys that next week, you know. But I mean, there's a lot of old movie stars and just old rich people who haven't redecorated since the 70s.
But it's also, I mean, Debbie is so obsessed with, like, Hollywood memorabilia. Yeah. And, you know, there's this scene at the auction where it's very Hoarders. It's like there's always that moment in the episode of Hoarders where the people are having second thoughts and they, like, decide they don't want to give this up. And that's what happens with Debbie and, like, the Rat Pack.
It's actually more than Hoarders. It's actually more because she's clearly holding on to something that is very real from her past, you know.
Exactly. And I think it's so sad, really. I mean, when you think she sort of bankrupted herself several times over to open this museum that, you know, never got off the ground. And when you think now that, you know, that Academy Museum they want to open, I mean, and I think it's going to be the greatest sort of folly ever. And Debbie, you know, had been trying to do that since, you know, since the MGM auction in the 70s. I mean, I think it is. I know that the son, Todd, does say that, you know, seeing your mother disappointed. I think there is some, it is kind of sad. I mean, of course, it is funny sort of thinking of her as this sort of, you know, like Marlene Dietrich in her Paris apartment being eaten by Alsatians. But, you know, there is something very endearing about it as well, on the other hand, I think.
Yeah. Well, and Carrie even says, like, my mother was a fan before she was ever a star.
Yes. Yeah.
And, like, when she gets the Lifetime Achievement Award near the end, it's like you can tell that actually means much to Debbie. Yeah. You know, as opposed to most huge stars, especially if they were born into fame, it's like, you know, it's just another day for them. But for Debbie, it's like she loves show business. She loves being.
Well, and also, as Carrie says, they did not throw awards at her.
So I know, and
special,
right? Yes. Mm.
But I want to know, does anyone know? I should have looked it up. But what was their financial status? Well, of both of them, but especially Debbie at the end.
Well, I know whenever she died, it said because I looked this up, she had a net worth of like $85 million.
Oh, okay. So she was great by the end.
Well, I know, but I mean, when you hear about, I mean, have you ever seen the interview of the two of them on Oprah in about 2010, I think, or 2011?
No.
Where she is showing, you know, the Marilyn Monroe subway dress and, you know, Julie Andrews Sound of Music costume and that. And I mean, she practically, you know, I think she had three auctions altogether to sell. I mean, this huge collection she had. So it was, I mean, I suppose $85 million is a nice nest egg. But
is that Daniel, is that a real number or is that like from one of those sites that says like celebrity net worth?
Oh, they're always so wrong, those net worth sites.
I have no idea. I just Googled it and that was the answer that came up.
Oh yeah, it's probably wrong.
She was a pauper, basically, I imagine.
She could have been. I mean, I was wondering it too, because like, for example, when she was playing the Mohegan Sun, I noticed all the empty seats in the house.
Oh yeah.
And I was like,
also a very big venue.
But, yes, and she did have a good crowd. It was just not nearly big enough for what the venue could hold.
But I do know that at one point, I'm not sure when this was, but Debbie was going bankrupt, and that's why she had to sell a lot of these items.
Mm. Well, I mean, it is so sad when you think of so many stars. I mean, Mickey Rooney, for example, died a pauper, basically, and was, you know, looking for solicitations from the public to sort of fund the... But that was from an awful abusive wife. I mean, I think Debbie had good family with her and of course supported her own family when Carrie said they didn't deserve it. Like the mother, who is such an the grandmother, I mean, you know, in Postcards, I mean, played by Mary Wicks. I mean, it's such a good.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, they interviewed Debbie's mom in this documentary. And she says something like, all her brains are in her ankles or something like that.
I was like, what does this joke mean? I didn't get it.
Well, I mean, the famous thing is that, you know, she wanted to be a gym teacher. It's like, you know, it's sort of like the legend it was created with that. It's like Lana Turner walking into Schwab's drugstore. Mm-hmm. It's that Debbie, all Debbie wanted to be was a gym teacher. And, you know, yet she was, you know, all the awful things that happened at MGM instead of, you know, being a gym teacher. And she would have been happy. And I think Billy Lord said that in an interview to, I don't know, Ellen or whoever, that, I don't know. I mean, certainly she was very talented and had her brains and her ankles or whatever the grandmother said, but...
Well, but she also says that she wishes she had Carrie's voice.
Well, that's, I think, such a such a interesting part of that documentary, because it kind of does explain the sort of relation, not explain it, but, you know, the fact that she wanted to be Carrie, she didn't want to be Debbie or Eddie, and that lovely scene where she sings Bridge Over Troubled Water as a kid.
15.
Yeah, and I mean, married the man that wrote it and called it Bridge Over Debbie's Daughter. But,
I mean, that scene is so powerful because Carrie's voice is really spectacular and it's so unique. And I was thinking, like, she could have been like a huge singer. Mm-hmm. Like, she could have been like
that. I was thinking this is very Lucy Arnaz. I mean, I loved watching her and I was impressed that she was doing that at 15. And she's such a great artist and she put so much heart and depth into stuff that she did that no doubt had she pursued that, she would have had something to offer that was worthwhile. But I wasn't like, oh, la voce, you know.
Oh, I was. I thought it was just so unique and like just rich and like the, I mean, she was just so open and just like belty and luscious. And then like, and then even to hear her singing later in the show, like whenever she just sings like to Debbie in her like little croony voice, I was like, there's like shades of like Rosemary Clooney here. Like Carrie actually, I think, had a really wonderful voice. Obviously, being the daughter of Eddie Fisher, it makes sense. But like,
speaking of Eddie Fisher's children's talent, can we talk about Todd a little bit?
Well, what I love is, go ahead.
Go on, Mark.
No, but I was going to say, I love when, I think I sort of get serious kind of Joey Luft vibes from Todd. And I sort of expect him to say, you know, that he loves shepherd's pie and the squares, the shapes that aren't squares. But I think he became a born again Christian or something, or some kind of.
Yes, that was my question. I got Jesus vibes from him.
I trust you guys on that. I saw the Bible quote outside the house and I was concocting a theory in my head that that was all Catherine Hickland, because everything he talked about, he just seemed to me like such a guy's guy. And like, even the way he talked about show business, like if you're born into it. And I was like, first of all, it pissed me off. I hate anybody that is born into anything, you know, but like, it seemed to me like he was much more excited about the god of show business of Debbie and Carrie with the Star Wars poster on his wall, you know, rather than, I felt like maybe Jesus was the wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe, I don't know.
I loved when they showed the little statue in the garden and it said the Fishers and the apostrophe was in the wrong place. It was.
Yes, oh my God. Obviously Carrie didn't take her red pin to that.
No, yeah.
But yeah, speaking of that, I mean, I've heard these stories about like George Lucas or whoever in Star Wars, like giving Carrie the scripts, and like Carrie actually like punched it up back in the day when she was, you know, like 20 or whatever. And that's something that is so apparent in this film. And we all know it, but just Carrie off the cuff even is just so smart. And she's just constantly just throwing out these one-liners that are brilliant. And, you know, like her former babysitter says in that one scene, even at 2, Carrie was the most interesting person I'd ever met.
Yeah.
And that's what I really took away this viewing, was how fucking smart Carrie is. And just those wheels are always turning. And she always is just, you know, giving you a one-liner that's so brilliant.
Totally. Mm. I also, I was thinking that, speaking of like with George Lucas, it was a little offensive to me when I forgot about this, or maybe it didn't hit me the same way when it first came out. But when they were talking about the weight she had to lose for Star Wars, for the new, for this, you know, the final Star Wars that she made. Yeah.
72.
Hilarious. Another Carrie fucking brilliant moment. But like, why? Why did she have to fucking lose weight to play 60-something Princess Leia?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's, I think that's really a good point. You know, it's Hollywood and aging actresses and all that.
Well, I mean, that caused, well, not a huge scandal, but I mean, you know, it was a big thing when that Star Wars 72 came out, that it was kind of fat shaming or, you know, older woman shaming, whatever the phrase is. And it kind of, you just think, I mean, what's the point? I mean, Meryl would never get that in a month of Sundays. It must be sort of, you know, they think because these Star Wars fans are sort of more, because I mean, all those recent ones are just totally, I mean, I, Oh, I don't know. I've lost my train of thought completely. Sorry.
I don't think that's fair about Meryl. I mean, you know, Meryl works very hard to be thin, and Carrie got fat at a certain point, you know, and Carrie carried a lot of weight for a long time. That Meryl, even at her, you know, Meryl has played the game to keep her body, you know, now in her 70s, maybe she's a little bit of a spread, but certainly nothing like Patty, you know. I mean, I think, you know, Carrie got chubby, and they wouldn't let her make the movie. And I think
Carrie is also some, like, you know, as we see in the Star Wars convention scene, Carrie was such a sex symbol back in the day.
True.
All these, you know, guys grew up jerking off to her. And totally. I mean, even me as a kid, like, I watched all the Star Wars movies, and as a kid, I was so obsessed with Princess Leia and Nicole Bikini.
Totally.
And, so I think that's also hard for audiences and Star Wars fans to kind of reconcile with is the fact that Carrie's older now, and she's no longer the sexy Princess Leia that they, you know, love so much.
Well, even me, I mean, I'm a Kinsey 6, let me tell you, you know, but I remember when I saw that last Star Wars movie that she was in, being like, oh my God, she looks so great. Ugh, I'm so happy has long gray hair. I can't believe how much weight she lost. I never thought I'd get to see her so thin again. This is amazing. I mean, why did I fucking care? Why was I invested in Carrie's waist size? But I was, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
Well, so, Mark,
I know. Do you feel that way? Do you give a shit if, you know, Glenn Close gets fat or Julianne Moore loses weight or whatever?
Well, I mean, we'd never hear the end of it if it was Julianne, but I don't really think about... No, I don't mean that. I don't... But I mean, that's the thing, though. I mean, people praise these. I mean, I think nowadays, I mean, people just don't know what acting is. And they, you know, sort of see Olivia Colman or somebody like that. And they think because they can cry on demand, it's the greatest performance ever. And these kind of transform, like Olivia Colman in The Favourite, where she did gain, I think, something like, you know, 15 pounds or whatever to play this. I know that's just the example I have that came to mind. But no, I really do not give a fig about how people look. I mean, remember Elizabeth Taylor in the 70s? I mean, that was the best Liz, I think.
Totally.
For sure.
But anyway.
Well, so Mark, I know you said that you have had quite a journey with Carrie because of, as you call it, the mental health aspect of it all, which I love. So do you want to talk about that?
Well, I mean, that's very immature now to say mental health. The other thing I say is Depressica Lang. And it's so immature. And I'm sure there's probably some people reading that and think, who does this person think they are to say that? Because, I mean, of course, I think Carrie did prove that you do have to have a sense of humor about it and that.
Yes.
But at the same time, I mean, of course, you can't say anything nowadays. But still, I really shouldn't call it mental health because... I think, I don't know, probably anti-Semitic or something. But no, I just think Carrie is someone that, I mean, I'm not saying that mental illness nowadays is fashionable, but certainly Carrie must have been the first. I mean, that really, I mean, I'm sure there are other ones, but, you know, Carrie's sort of openness from, you know, what, 30 years ago when Postcards came out, it does.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm sure all of us can't really remember a time when she wasn't sort of open about that. And I just think it is,
totally.
I think it is very heartening. I mean, I'm sure there is, you know, some kind of element that thinks, oh, well, would she not just keep it to herself? But I mean, I do think it does mean a lot to people. And certainly that is why, as I said earlier on, when they did die in 2016, there was this connection where, you know, I don't think it would have been otherwise. I mean, I think that is what kind of pushed her beyond, as talented and as wonderful as she was. But I think it really was the most salient sort of connection with the fans, with Carrie anyway. I mean, she wrote a book called Shockaholic and another one called Wishful Drinking. And I mean, even though I don't think she was an alcoholic as such, but it's a good title. But and even that HBO special she did of Wishful Drinking. I mean, Yeah, sorry, I'm the most disappointing guest ever. I
no, you're fabulous.
No, no.
So, you know, but it's a wonderful point you make because I don't think that it's become so de rigueur or however you pronounce that, you know, that the idea that people can be open about their substance abuse problems and their mental health stuff. I mean, you just hear it now. It's an excuse that people use anytime they get a DUI or anything, you know, but it actually, as you pointed out, was really groundbreaking for Carrie to take ownership of that. And like you said, for so many decades, the only way, you know, certainly people, even, I mean, I'm 44, to be honest, but even at my age, I still cannot remember a time when that wasn't part of the story around her, you know. But it's interesting watching this documentary because I think, you know, I was 12 or so when Postcards from the Edge came out. And I loved the movie right away. And I was very aware that it was Carrie Fisher's book and based on Carrie Fisher's book and that it was about Carrie and Debbie, you know. And I think in my 12-year-old mind, and I have a feeling in a lot of people's minds, there was sort of this idea that Carrie had these problems and now she's cured and now we move on with Hollywood, you know? And I think what's became true later in Carrie's openness in interviews and that show that I talked about, Dinner for Five, and of course all of her subsequent books and her one-woman show on Broadway and on HBO, Wishful Drinking, and very much in this documentary, is that Carrie's struggles, and we know now about the facts of her death, her struggles were not something that were cured overnight in 1987 or whatever, but that were a persistent problem. And, you know, and as you, I mean, you said you don't know whether or not she's an alcoholic. And that's a good point to make too, because for me to relate to her as an alcoholic is actually very much a small piece of the pie, because what you see in this documentary is that in Carrie's life, if not every single day, then every single month, a very persistent, debilitating problem is that mental illness that she has.
Well, I think even the addiction side of it, I mean, when you think of like how many cans of Coke she drank and the shopping and all, it just sort of, I mean, I meant strictly sort of alcohol. I mean, I know it was pills and that she liked, but I do think she definitely was that sort of addictive personality that is, like she says about her father, and, you know, when she says about caring for her father and that he didn't deserve to get that sort of care in the last year of his life. You know, someone has that kind of addictive personality. It does make them irresistible to people, even though they are sort of beleaguered with all these problems. But I think that's, again, the appeal of her. I mean, everything she did is just so kind of, you know, when she's touring her house, and it's just so, when you think kind of like every little item, whether it's the poster that says child of divorce or the picture of a Prozac. I mean, she was buried in a Prozac urn. No, she was. It was like a china urn in the shape of a Prozac pill.
And, so good.
And that she just kind of had hanging around the house. I mean, they didn't know what to put her in, and they remembered, oh, this is in the kitchen or something. And I think it was a cookie jar, or I don't know, but, you know, it's just kind of a...
Well, and it's so the anti-Debbie. You know, Debbie's someone who always wanted to be in control. And, you know, when they're walking into the ceremony at the end, Debbie's like, act like we're just talking, act like everything's fine. I mean, Debbie, and, you know, she wouldn't let the cameras in that one day when she was feeling bad. I mean, everything was always in its place. And Carrie was the opposite of that and rejected that. And, you know, she wanted a house that was the opposite of the one she grew up in. As she said, we didn't grow up with each other. We grew up around each other like trees. And so like Carrie was someone who was just not going to bullshit, you know, but actually go to the opposite end of the spectrum and actually irreverently and comically address these issues head on, whether it was in her writing or in her choice of home decor. And I mean, there's so much we could talk about Carrie's house, but the one thing I want to mention is at the very beginning when it's taking you on the tour and in her bathroom, there's a poster hanging of Debbie doing like a shampoo ad. And not only is it hanging, but it's signed. And there's a message and a signature from Debbie and it's signed Mama. And then it says Debbie. And then in parentheses, it says Reynolds. That is. Which I love. Like, to her own daughter, Debbie still signs Debbie Reynolds.
Well, that's
just
the famous
catchphrase. Daniel. Is that a catchphrase? Reynolds, well, that is?
No, she always rang up and said, hello, dear, this is your mother, Debbie. I mean, that was what she was known for.
Yeah.
Back to what you were just saying, though, Daniel, about the, you know, Carrie's talking honestly about things versus the Debbie ethos of you know, they're putting up the smiley face for the camera and everything. Those were the two things for me that were actually, I never cry, but I cried watching this last night because I cried with Debbie watching when it became a strain for her to put her best foot forward, you know, and never more than when it wasn't a strain. When she had that difficult interview that she cut short, and then as she walked out with her back to the camera and she did a little bit of a Chaplin bit on her way out. You know, I mean, it's like what's, you know, both sides now. Now it's just another show. You leave them laughing when you go, you know, and Debbie did that. You know, she exited with style. But
on her terms.
On her terms. But it was heartbreaking because you knew exactly how she was feeling and what was going on. And the parallel thing for me watching this, rather not for me with so much emphasis, the parallel thing for me watching this with Carrie was when she was in bed in the middle of a depressive episode. Yeah. And she, you know, she talked about the two sides of her personality. What was it, Roy? And I forget.
Roy and Pam.
Pam. And she was in a Pam moment. And she was lying in bed just with her head on the pillow and describing what, you know, what that's like. And it was so naked. And it was with zero pretension. And even, you know, this idea of making the character names and all that, I mean, it's a way of understanding things, and it's funny as you describe her being irreverent and all that, you know, her, the way she uses humor to make an audience or a reader or, you know, a viewer, really understand the nuance and, you know, what the experience of her humanity is, you know, but in that moment, we've already gotten the joke about Roy and Pam, and now she's just as Pam. Yeah. And it's really took my breath away. But in a way, it's the same thing as Debbie. I mean, I guess that's another thing about Grey Gardens, besides all the trappings of another way that this is like Grey Gardens, besides all the trappings of the funny, eccentric thing about them and living together and, you know, being sort of Hollywood being kind of finished with them or the patriarchy or whatever, the same way that it was with the Beals. But also that way that they are so yin and yang and different, but they're really two sides of the same coin, and we just see the there's a pain or something inside that's exactly alike.
I mean, it's truly it's a story about how they deal with loss. Mm. Like, I think, you know Debbie loses her husband, Eddie Fisher, and, you know, you see this footage of her addressing reporters, and she's like, just so like, everything's okay. Like, well, I guess we'll have to blah, blah, blah. And then, but then the hoardings, you know, she starts hoarding or whatever. It's like, you see her, how she deals with this.
I'm so happy you said those together, because it's what I was, couldn't think of, but I think you answered my question from the beginning of like, what is she holding on to with the hoarding? I mean,
that's like her memories. Like, she's like, these are my boys.
Hollywood, you know, and it's sad because in fact, Hollywood fucked her over. I mean, the person that stole her husband, if you want to, you know, not to really exist on those terms, but literally her husband left her for Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah, like the queen mother of Hollywood.
But that is what Debbie didn't let go of.
Yeah. And then, you know, Carrie, she lost her father. I mean, and if you really want to get down to it, we joke about Carrie's Coca-Cola obsession, but like, Eddie Fisher was the spokesperson for Coke back in the day.
Oh my God. Right.
And so like, the fact that Carrie is literally like walking around with a can of Coke at all hours, all the time, it's like so symbolic. And, you know, her addiction and just her, as she says, it would be so cool to get to the end of my personality. It's like, she just constantly wants more. Mm-hmm. And she's doing something to deal with this loss of her father and her childhood.
What did you guys think about that scene on her father's sickbed?
I thought it was quite touching, actually. I mean, it was, you know, it was, as she said about Debbie's mother and about Eddie, I mean, they didn't deserve that kind of care and attention, but it was sort of making things right at the end of their lives, I suppose. It was sort of, you know, it was, I mean, Carrie always said that Eddie would rock up to Wishful Drinking and would sort of be cured by show business, by applause, and, you know, was totally senile at that point and thought everybody was Obama. But, you know, it is that kind of, I mean, it is, you know, I don't know, I don't really want to say well, it is the family business. I'm sure, you know, butchers and candlestick makers feel the same way. But as Todd said at the beginning, you know, it does gel them. And it is, I don't know, I just found it very interesting. I mean, I'm sure Eddie Fisher didn't know what was going on, and certainly Carrie straight in with a comment about, you know, am I more beautiful than Elizabeth Taylor? I mean, you know, it just shows how people have these kind of things that they're utterly fixated on, and, you know, will bring them up at any cost.
Mm. Yeah, and, you know, they talk so much about...
Elizabeth really is, in this, I think, is sort of a character that's there, even though she's...
Exactly.
I mean, the scene where, you know, they're going through Debbie's closet and they find this muumuu from, you know, that belonged to Elizabeth in the 70s.
Yes, the other woman.
I mean, absolutely, and it's almost like in Rebecca when, you know, you never see... Well, that's, so exaggerated, but it is... I mean, she is that presence that, you know... I don't know. I don't know whether that was intentional. I mean, I don't really.
That's so true, though. Yeah.
I don't really get a sense, though, that the people that made this documentary. I know they were obviously friends of Carrie Fisher Stevens.
Yeah, Fisher Stevens. Yeah.
But it isn't. It isn't kind of, you know, a sort of. It's not very Hollywoody. It's not that entertainment, if you know what I mean.
Which
is, I think, what makes it so kind of different from sort of a. And I can't really think of a. Hollywood documentary that would be kind of comparable, but you know, there's an edge to it.
I think that's why we love it so much. And I know whenever,
well, it's atypical. I mean, when you think, did you see that film Tea with the Dames about Maggie Smith? And
yes, so good.
I mean, that was a DVD extra. It wasn't a documentary at all. I mean, you know, whereas this has that kind of, you know, I think it's what makes it interesting, really.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, I think, you know, what I was realizing watching this is in the beginning when I was just like kind of surprised by how immediately thrilled I was to be watching this again, when I really thought I was going to like be annoyed to have to like slog through it, you know, only as I said before, because I had watched it when it first came out, which was not that long ago. And it felt like I collected it, like I digested it. I had no need to watch it again. But what I realized, and it was, I was thinking about this in terms of other things Daniel had put on our list of possibilities, whether with you or another corn streamer, the Elaine Stritch documentary and the Joan Rivers documentary. And I had similar feeling about those, that I had already like gotten everything I wanted to get out of watching them. So why would I wouldn't really be excited to like spend an hour or two having to rewatch it now. But what I realized, and I think it would be true for those also, is because of what you say, Mark, because it has that edge of not being a DVD extra, of actually being like really like a little bit like a, I don't know if the right expression is fly on the wall, but you really do feel like you're spending time truly with these people as they truly are, getting really sort of a taste of them, of what they're really like, and of what they're, of what makes them tick. And I think it would be the same for me with Elaine and Joan's documentaries, in that it feels like hanging out with them. And they're these fascinating people whose work was so important. I can say without confirming, I know I can speak for both of you, that the work of these women is so important to who we have become as people ourselves, and as strong Black women. And so therefore, they're always with you. And so to get to go hang out with them in that sense is actually like a treat, as opposed to, here's an example you were looking for, Mark, a documentary that's not like that, besides That's Entertainment, would be the Carol Channing documentary.
Hmm.
Have you seen that?
I don't think I have, actually. I'm kind of, no, I haven't. God, I'm ashamed.
Have you seen it, Daniel?
Yes.
Right. Do you agree? I mean, it's a good movie. It's a great, fun thing to watch, but it's definitely like a, doesn't get her humanity in the way that the Joan one does, or this does, or for, you know, whatever.
Right. And I mean, I know when Carrie, I think, first saw a cut of this, she was kind of taken aback by how intimate it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then she kind of had to be convinced, and she finally, you know, agreed that that was how it needed to be. But, you know, it shows them, like, when she goes over with that souffle, it shows them, like, digging in with two forks, sitting on the step of Debbie's living room. Like, it's just no glamour whatsoever.
Yeah.
Even though, as Carrie says, Debbie's laying on the floor in a very Debbie movie star way. And then it shows you all around the house. I mean, on Debbie's coffee table, which, you know, I paused on and zoomed in. It's like there's like a holy Bible on top of like some book about Noel Coward with like an ashtray for Carrie with like, you know, a bottle of Listerine or whatever. It's like, I mean, I'm sure Debbie like cleaned up or whatever before they came over, but it really is just a glimpse into who they were and how they lived together.
People forget about Debbie's sort of religious faith. I mean, she was a Nazarene and, you know, grew up in this almost in a sect practically in Texas or somewhere, I think. And they forbade people from even go, I think they forbade people from going to movies. They forbade everything. Mm. So it's kind of, she does have that puritanical streak. And it's sort of, I often think, you know, she kind of had nearly maybe like an enfant terrible sort of innocence. I mean, where she's that scene where she says about, you know, wanting Carrie to sleep with a gay chorus boy from Irene, and that she would supervise it and sort of, you know.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to say it's kind of tactless, but it is sort of that kind of, it's an innocence and it's a lovely thing, really. She would have been what, in her 50s then? I mean, it still just shows that she did have that kind of, you know, that Tammy sort of, I mean, she sort of became Tammy in a way, didn't she? You know, it was her, that
Talk
kind of.
Talk to me about Tammy. I've never seen it. And I realize every time I watch this, I'm like, what's the deal with Tammy?
Well, it was her one kind of hit as a song. I mean, I don't think I've even ever seen that. They made a few of them. I think they made another one with Connie Stevens and another one with, I don't know whether. They made a series of Tammy films in the 50s and 60s, but it was the hit record for Debbie, which annoyed Eddie Fisher seemingly that, you know, she had a, but really though, when you think of Debbie's films and you think of sort of Singing in the Rain and maybe The Unsinkable Molly Brown, I mean, what else do you think of? I mean, you think of the single for Tammy, maybe you think of, I don't know, Charlotte's Web, maybe. I mean, that isn't.
Yeah, right. Yeah, go ahead. Or, I mean, Will and Grace. I mean, honestly, like, where else to go?
But that is the thing. I mean, it isn't like Elizabeth or whoever that you have this sort of compact. You don't think, you know, National Velvet and then Place in the Sun and Giant, and you don't work your way through. I mean, it is very kind of.
It's funny, Mark, you just made me think of Liza because, and I would never have thought about this before, because I always think of this sort of tragedy of Liza, that she had this sort of like meteoric explosion in Hollywood and then immediately it was over. And she really, in a sense, she never worked again. And she spent the rest of her career touring essentially the same act. And but then it's kind of like Debbie, sort of, except that it was just Debbie was at the era in Hollywood when.
But the thing about Debbie is, though, that I think is so interesting is that, you know, when she made those, I don't know, she made like a Whatever Happened to Baby Jane film with Shelley Winters in the 70s, Whatever Happened
Really?
Whatever, I can't remember the name of it, but it was one of those sort of schlock horror films. And she didn't make another film for 25 years. And yet she was, you know, only a woman in her 40s was finished. When you think of the kind of films Shirley MacLaine was doing at the same time.
Yeah, right.
That Debbie absolutely could have done. And, you know, Shirley always resented Debbie for getting the role in Molly Brown, which she thought was kind of, you know, her, because it was the only it was the only time Debbie was up for an Oscar, actually, was for that.
And Mark, why do you say that Debbie absolutely could have done the films Shirley MacLaine did? Why are you confident about that?
Because she's a great dramatic actress and people forget that. People think she's...
I don't know that. Tell me. I didn't know that.
Have you never seen A Catered Affair, the one with Betty Davis?
No,
and,
I've only seen the shitty musical with Faith Prince and Leslie Grenzer.
Yeah, well, that's quite an interest. You know, she plays sort of the Brooklyn daughter whose mother wants the big white wedding. I mean, it is a very kind of, you know, kitchen sink sort of a pretends to be Marty sort of film.
Really? Oh, you made me want to watch it.
Well, I suppose it's okay, but I mean, she's good in that. And certainly, you know, I don't know. I don't think really they kind of knew. I mean, obviously she was the girl next door at MGM and always played that kind of, but it just shows how people were so typecast and didn't get a chance to do those more interesting roles. And, you know, Debbie has said that she would have loved to have done Shirley's role in The Turning Point. I mean, she wanted to play herself in Postcards from the Edge, but Mike Nichols didn't think, you know, anyone would buy it.
Right.
Some wonderful remark like that. But, you know, it is. And I think she was a bit upset at the portrayal of Shirley that in Postcards too, you know, the scene where she pours the vodka into the blender and, you know, different things that I think people forget that Debbie and Carrie were estranged for something like 15 years in the 80s and 90s. You know, you wouldn't think
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. Are you sure it was that long?
Well, it certainly was a little while where Debbie where Carrie definitely wanted to get out of the shadow of Debbie. I mean, yeah, you know, Debbie in her biography tells wonderful stories of, you know, when Carrie didn't show up to the wedding of Debbie and her third husband, you know, she got Ava Ava Gardner to, you know, locate her in a London hotel where she was sort of,
oh my God,
you know, passed out on Percodan or whatever, which which I think is a great thing if you can get your mother to, you know, find Ava Gardner and get you out of your...
can you imagine?
Ava Gardner does the best interventions in Hollywood.
Right, right. Go to Ava. She's your gal.
Ava was wonderful too. I mean, she confused the ladies' room for the lift in the Ritz in Madrid and was sort of banned from life because she, you know, she was a terrible alcoholic. But
well, you can't spell Ava without AA.
That's right.
I'm just working on it, working on material.
I think really alcoholism is the great common thread with all these women. I mean, let's face it, I don't think Glenn is an alcoholic, but, you know, it is the base sort of thing we go for when we choose these divas to worship. Well, one of them anyway.
Well, the largesse anyway. I mean, it's, you know, it's like you said, the addictive personality, you know, it's that craving always for more of everything.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, I would always crave more of you, Mark. I think we'll have to have you back to talk about some other thing in the future.
I know. I think this episode has been, well, I mean, you were wonderful, but I feel I flopped on it. I was rambling and I didn't say one coherent thing for the whole hour we were on.
Rambling is our brand.
Absolutely. You're perfectly coherent. It's just that fucking accent's so annoying, but otherwise you were divine.
Thank you. Well, this accent is so fake anyway. I felt I was, you know, going to lapse into the harsh tones of my native Dublin when I was asked something I didn't want to answer.
Do it!
No, I'm only joking. But it was great, and I hope the sound isn't too bad for your listeners. I mean,
they're lucky to get to hear from you at all. They would crawl belly deep through hell.
They've heard much worse.
That's for sure.
Oh, I know. Well.
Wait, should we play our game with Mark?
Oh, yes, we must.
Okay, well, do you know our game, Dolly Concert Kill?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
Okay, so we have to do Debbie.
Mm-hmm. Shirley.
And Glenn.
Well, when I do this game and Shirley comes up, I mean, I do say kill her because she'd come back with her past lives.
That's right.
Clever.
So I don't know. I think Glenn would be so earnest in Hello, Dolly. I mean, you'd be waiting for her to find the one laugh in the whole show. I don't know. I mean, I think Debbie kind of was a bit long. I'd like to see Glenn do a concert, actually. And Debbie is Dolly and kill Shirley. I mean,
yeah, I agree with that. Glenn.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
Yes. Up close and personal.
Oh.
All right. Yeah. Well, do you have anything? Obviously, all our listeners worship you and they know where they can find you on Instagram, but are you expanding the brand anytime soon?
Yeah.
Are you branching out into other platforms?
Well, I was going to try and I was sort of half thinking, would I, you know, start a podcast? Because it does seem like the next step for sort of tragic accounts like mine. But after doing this interview, I think I'll never do one again. I was so nervous.
No, but you definitely should do one. That'd be fab.
Yeah.
And you could have us on it.
Yeah. Yeah. You could have Shirley on it. You've whet my appetite. I want to read. Is that blog still up that you wrote before you had the Insta?
No, thank God. It isn't. I should reboot it, maybe. I just hate that name, though, Dublin Zoetrope. It's such an awful name. I don't know why. I know where I got it from, but I just...
Well, I know you and I have had this conversation. I think you should change it to your real name.
Yeah, I know. Well, what happened was a few weeks ago, I did ask sort of every prestige gay that follows me, should I change it? And they all said, oh, no, keep it. It's your brand. But I wish it was.
No, they are right. All the prestige gays were right. You should keep it as your
book. I say change it to your real name. It will be much easier and it makes more sense going forward if you're wanting to do more.
Yeah.
But, well, you know, that's between you and God and Shirley MacLaine.
Oh, tell us, you just said you know where you got the name. Where did you get the name?
Oh, I plagiarized it from American Zoetrope, as you said at the beginning. You know, Sofia Coppola's company. I mean, talk about a sort of random name. But it reminds me of Zoetrim, which is a weight loss supplement in my country.
And oh, my God.
I don't know how many calories you're allowed a day, but it's less than they were getting in the Warsaw Ghetto.
So, oh, my God. Wait, so you know, live in Dublin?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't like the Dublin either because, you know, the Glentrification. So I wanted to change that. But anyway, I know. It was a lovely having me on. I'm so surprised. And I feel as though I should say, now we'll sing them all and we'll stay all night or something. Because
Do you have an encore prepared?
No, I did. I'm surrounded by all these notes. I haven't said a thing of them. And the other thing is, I thought this was going to be a video. I'm sitting here, sort of dressed lovely, lovely lights.
And
I know we were, obviously, we'll go out as a podcast, but I thought, you know, maybe I would see you as we were talking. And I said none of these notes I had, so I don't know. But I'm very grateful for you to have me on.
Was there any? I only wrapped it up because I knew you had said you wanted to keep it to 45 minutes, and we were way over that. But do you tell us everything else you have?
Oh no, I mean nothing really. I mean, I think it has all been mentioned. But it was lovely being on, and I mean, you probably
you so much for joining us.
Yes,
well, thank you, and thank you to all your listeners, and this is the speech that Glenn had prepared and never gave. So rambling. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to Ben Rimmelauer's Broken Records on Broadway World. For more episodes, visit Broadway World, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts do be. And be sure to check out our new twice-weekly live stream video chat, Tuesday, Thursday, April, August.
This episode was edited by me, Daniel Nolan.
Thanks to Emmy-winning composer and lyricist Lance Horn for the Broken Records theme song.
Follow us both, Ben Rimmelauer and Daniel Nolan, on all y'all's socials.
That's Ben Rimmelauer, B-E-N... R-I-M-A-L-O-W-E-R.
And that's Nolan with an E, not Nolan with an A.
Because Nolan with an A is an ass.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.